What I'm going to present, and I think about the first half an hour or so, you better time me, give me a 5-minute warning, is something I've been working on. It's really not a biblical study, though it's a survey of biblical history from one angle, and that's the angle of land tenure. I guess the reason why I studied this is that as I was studying a lot of other Old Testament, living in the Chicago area during the civil rights business, and that man Fred Hampton, whom the Chicago police shot, no question about that. And you still see graffiti around Chicago, Fred Hampton lives, was at a meeting at our school, Concordia Teachers College, simply asked the question, what you've got to give us, you white, is land. And then I began to notice what, of course, is always there, if you look at it, what was the land tenure situation? And what I found is that in ancient Israel, you alluded to it the other day, there was a kind of an ongoing social reform, a system that was part of their covenant. It wasn't just haphazard. It wasn't just what could be done. It was part of the Old Testament covenant relationship with Yahweh. And therefore, I found that as a rather fruitful approach to social reform in ancient Israel in general. So it's more land reform. Now, if we were sitting around in the evening at a campfire in Israel, and in what they call a sod, kind of a council, where you talked about serious things, and the elders told stories and so forth, when they talked about land, this is a sort of stories. You see, there wasn't a Bible yet, it was just oral traditions. The first stories would be that this land, which they all knew had once belonged to the Canaanites, had been promised to the patriarchs, to the forefathers, Abram and Jacob and Isaac and so forth, long ago, even when they were mere nomads going through it. And that wasn't just only a promise, let's say, to a nomad of new grazing land, which is very, very important for the existence, but also arable land. You see, except for Menachem Begin today, who for him that's the big promise to Israel, the land. Most Christians, when they read the Bible, they always say, well, it's just the promise of the family and the seed, and that's the important thing. But they don't realize that that's very deep in the tradition, and I'm quite sure it's historically true. The second thing that they would tell in such stories around the fireside would be the story of how, in the Holy Wars, the Lord had conquered this. It wasn't Joshua. Sure, Joshua and his men did the fighting, and then they finally got a foothold there in the hills, and then finally the judges, and it was a long time of penetration and settlement. But that's the way we look at it in secular terms, with military things. But in the Bible, you have very few West Point military details. It's always the Holy War, in which at the climax the Lord invisibly smites the enemy. And what happened then at the end of the Holy War, at least of Joshua's phase of it, is that they allotted the land to the people, to the tribes, to the clans. And if you look carefully, there's a lot of rivalry between the clans. Some of them felt they didn't get big enough shares and all the sort of things that you could expect. But what was really important is that they looked upon this as the land belongs to the Lord. Let me give you a passage here which says it in so many words. The land is the Lord's, and you are but sojourners among him. This idea that they were just, the land must not be sold in perpetuity. In other words, even though it was allotted to a clan and to a family and so forth, and they had a certain amount of freedom in dealing with it, it could not be sold in perpetuity, for it belongs to me, and to me you are only strangers and guests. This is Leviticus 25:23. Then another thing that came before, well, let me just give you an example of that. If you had your first fruits, and the laws of the first fruits are rather interesting, this was common. You have it already in the Cain and Abel story, that the first if you're hunting, the first that you get is given to the Lord. That's widespread among mankind. The first of the fish that you give is to the Lord, or to the deity that has given this to you. And that's why Cain and Abel didn't need a special promise to give the produce that they had to the Lord. They expressed, of course, their relationship to him thereby. And so you have the same thing. But now, Fenrod especially has found in Deuteronomy 26, what he calls a little historical creed. And so just like we at a certain important point might recite the Apostles' Creed, the Trinitarian Creed, they have in Deuteronomy 26, 1-11, when you come into the land and you have this first fruits, and now you bring it to the Lord, this is what you must say. And then there's a creed. Article number one is what? A wandering Aramean was my father, that's Jacob. And then the Lord took him and made of him a great nation. Then they went down to Egypt and were enslaved. Then the Lord brought them out. That's Article 2. Then when he led them through the wilderness, Article 3, and brought them to this land. And then there's a quote, as the farmer would put this down on the altar to sanctify it and give it to the Lord. And he, that's Article 4, brought us unto this place and gave us this land, a land where milk and honey flow. And behold, now I bring the fruit of the ground which thou, O Yahweh, hast brought to me. Thus the land which the farmer had in which he worked was concretely linked to that history of salvation. And there was an ongoing system, therefore, of social care that simply was part of the covenant. It becomes a very vivid that there were stipulations to holding land. It wasn't just the sacred right of private property or something like that, or playing off property rights over against human rights in Initiative 13 and all the rest of that. If you realize that there were limitations on the use of it, and the allotment, it belonged to the Lord, and you were merely stewards of it, if you want to use that word, and there were stipulations on how to use it. For instance, land could not, I've quoted that one already, be sold in perpetuity. Not even if an Israelite became so poor that for a time he practically had to sell himself and everything else to the guy that had what he needed and had to borrow from him. You had to have arrangements for redemption. And it was redemption not only to family, like you have in that family of Elimelech in the book of Ruth, that there had to be, no family could die out, even when all the male members of that family had died out, then there was the right that Ruth had when she came on the threshing floor to Boaz, that rich farmer, and said to do to her after what we call it, the law of the levirate, the law of the kinsman. And make that long story short, he did raise up seed for the dead and redeem the property of the family. So I think this is a very, very clear thing, that the basis for the existence of a family was guaranteed. And no family should die out, and its allotted land should not be there. And if somebody had come close to being enslaved, and that was still one of the social institutions of the time, in the seventh year, he was free. But the Sabbath law in Exodus 23 included also fields, vineyards, olive groves. The gleanings of grain and vine, and you mentioned also the olive, was to be left for the poor, kind of a social welfare system which enabled the hunger passerby to satisfy hungry, or the poor to go out and glean. The annual tithe that was given to the Lord didn't only just go to the priests. At the sanctuary, there would also be the poor. It was my good fortune to travel in Ethiopia for about 3 weeks, and one of the things I noticed among the Ethiopians, and they still have a lot of that, is that the tourists get sick and tired of it, but that's their problem. There is a real, for people who make the pilgrimage, Ethiopians, with the old sense, a sense in which you do help the poor. And they're lined up there, and they're taken care of, and they partake of the barbecue. In the Psalms, when it says, a psalm of thanksgiving, and a person came there, hear ye things of the Lord, what the Lord did to me. And then the man would tell, I was in trouble, and then I cried unto the Lord, and he heard me, and he gave me, and now I'm praising him. There was not only singing and dancing, there was a barbecue, and that included the poor, anybody who was there. And you would have the smell of feathers, because the poorest offering that you could bring would be that Mary and Joseph brought of a turtle dove. And then you knew there were poor there. So the poor were always there at the sanctuary. And these modern concepts that we have elevated to idolatry, with the sacred right of private property and the devil take the hindmost, were simply not there. The social welfare system for the poor existed by the specific command of the Lord. And there is an awful lot of legislative material in the Constitution of Israel, that's Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, and it's been studied by a lot of scholars, and we can sum up that these so-called Mosaic laws, Moses was the mediator of that covenant, and they were reformulated and updated many, many times by other successors to Moses. Mediators of the covenant, charismatic people, who and most generally priests too. It was an official sort of leadership role. And you'll find judges and other people, Samuel, renewing the covenant and doing this many, many times, updating it and also including this business of land tenure. And without going into all of that, let me give you just a few examples of how their legal system worked on this. Most of it was done right in the village, and the elders at the gate would do it. And we have their precedent law, casuistry law, a lot of that. If A happens, then B is what you do. And it's the precedent law that we have in our legal tradition.
Precedent?
Precedence, yes. Mm-hmm. Let's say, for instance, this would be one of the laws. These were first oral, you see that, and then later they were written down. About the time they were going out of style, and people write things down, you see, when they're a living sort of thing, then it doesn't bother. But in Exodus, this so-called Book of the Covenants, very old collection, in Exodus 21, 22, and 23, Exodus 22, 25 says, if you lend money to any of my people who is poor, you shall not be to him as a creditor. You shall not exact interest from him. If ever you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, that's the outer garment, kind of your sleeping bag, you shall restore it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering. It is his mantle for his body. In what else shall he sleep? You can see they're getting after these people. If for one or other reason they couldn't agree on the local level among these village elders, the case could be appealed to the Supreme Court. And that would be to the sanctuary, the local sanctuary, or later after the Jerusalem set up, it'd be in Jerusalem, and the king, or later on the high priest, would take care of it there. But the priests proclaimed the will of God not that way in precedent. If A happens, then B is what you do. But in actual first person singular, and second person addressed to the people. For instance, they often have, as we'll speak of in a moment, they had covenant renewal festivals in which everybody simply had to renew this covenant, and it was put on the conscience of everybody. You just couldn't enter church with that day, you might say, without renewing this. And they would simply say, in the name of God, you shall not cheat any poor man of you of his rights at law. Or that isn't the only way it was done. It was also done in the backwoods by the minor clergy, especially after David set up everything and centralized everything at the Jerusalem. And the other priests kept on in all of the sanctuaries round about until, of course, they had the big reformation that I'll talk about, the big chance for social reform of King Josiah. And then they kind of said you can't have shed blood outside because they wanted to control the religion. And then, of course, they made those minor clergymen, the non-Jerusalemite clergy, what we call kind of in general the Levites, second-class clergy, they made them village priests. And that was a marvelous thing about King Josiah's Reformation, that he, instead of putting those guys out of work, he gave them a job to inculcate the Torah, the law. And we have in the collections, especially in the book of Deuteronomy, a lot of the, such formulations of this material. For instance, this is one, Deuteronomy 24:19. When you reap your harvest and have forgotten a sheaf in the field, you shall not go back to get it. It shall be for the sojourner, the fatherless, the widow, that Yahweh your God may bless you in the work of your hand. And that's especially the sort of thing, it's kind of homiletical. It's not so much the precedent or the covenant renewal festival, but it's homiletical in all these various types of things that you've got in the covenant. And I might say that these laws, these Torah, are all equal to the first commandment. Vern and I talked just a little last night about the covenant. And now, there were in the ancient Near East covenants, not only between suzerains and vassals, overlords, and subjects, and sometimes they were parity covenants between equals. Sometimes they were a suzerainty covenant when a overlord would simply say, this is the way we'll establish order. Now, in the case of the Lord and the Sinaitic covenant, he simply starts it off when he announces the covenant, I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. And that's the way he would have it among the Hittites or anything. I'm Supalulim, the king of the Kati. And then he would describe all the relationships between him and, say, the king of Kiri or something like that. Then, instead of having it the way the king, say, of the Hittites would have, I don't want you to have make any covenants and have any other relationships with other kings and so forth. The Lord says, you shall have no other gods before me. It doesn't mean, as we have tended to do it in Western civilization, no other god should exist. No other god exists. I'm the only god that exists. That's perhaps a truth too. They all turn out to be illusions. But they very well knew people, as now, choose other gods and fear and love and trust other things and other persons more than the true God. And so what it really means, that first commandment, is you're going to get hurt if you trust anyone else but me. And all these stipulations are part of that fundamental stipulation. I am your overlord, you are my vassals. And therefore, when they sinned against any one of these stipulations, they weren't just doing naughty little things against the minor commandment. What they were doing is breaking the covenant. Now that became quite clear. And when they, the way in which they promulgated that in the classical period of, let's say, the formative age of Israel, was largely when the tribes gathered together, and they usually gathered at Shechem because there's a large plain there. It's kind of, Judges 9 calls it the belly button of the land, where the east and the north and the south, and north-south roads gather. And there they renewed this covenant. And they got the people right there. I suppose and people means in this case all the elders. And although later, sometimes in the later parts, post-exilic times, it included women and children too. I don't know. That's a footnote. But at least the people, whether it was only representatives, I don't know whether everybody was there, but at least the people who gathered there, the heads of the clans and everyone else, had to renew this covenant. And all these laws were in some way updated. And applied. In fact, this is really, during that tribal period, the only way that they got together at all, except for holy wars. If there was an emergency and they blew the trumpet and they had a holy war, then they would get together to fight. Or they came together for a covenant renewal festival. And as they came together for this covenant renewal festival, priests later were on one side, Mount Gerizim, and the Levites, the minor clergy, on Mount Ebal. And the priests would pronounce the blessings if they kept the covenant, and the Levites the curses if they didn't. And let's just take some of the curses, just to give you an example of that. There's a whole list of them in Deuteronomy 27, 28 is the blessings. 27, just two of them are typical for fostering what we're talking about here, social justice. Verse 17 is, cursed be he who displaces his neighbor's boundary mark. And all the people have to say, amen. And that's the curse of God. And the next one is, cursed be he who tampers with the rights of the stranger and the orphan and the widow. And all the people say, amen. And you know, when you made a pilgrimage later to Jerusalem and you came to the entrance, the gate of Jerusalem, you couldn't just barge in there like a clod. You had to have kept the covenant. Who shall stand in his holy hill? He who has not lifted up his soul into vanity, worshipped a false god, who has not had blood in his hand, whose heart is pure. This was it. And this idea that you could be free and loose and come to communion without being repentant, that just didn't work. And actually, they had as much problems as we did with that. But this idea that you could live in impenitence, this wasn't in the cards at all. In other words, they had an ongoing system in ancient Israel which had social implications. And I suppose you might say that in this way, the change that came with the monarchy, and this guy in Michigan by the name of Mendenhall has done a lot of this work, and he just thinks that monarchy is the worst thing that ever happened to Israel. You remember that when they first wanted to make a king and they asked one of the judges, Gideon, be our king. Does anyone know what the answer was when they say, you be our king and your whole family be our king? I'll not be your king. My son will not be your king because the Lord is your king. I don't want the office. And to have a king in place of the real king, who used the setup of all the priests and the covenant setup, would threaten to make an idol out of him. If you see the King Tut exposition when it comes to saddle, then you will see what an idol the king was like. He was magic. And Samuel, as soon as they mentioned this, we'd like to have a king the way that all the other people have. It's the only way we can stand up against the Philistine threat. We've got to have a permanent army. We've got to have a king. And then all Samuel did is says, yeah, I've been pastor here for 37 years, and now when I'm old, they want to kick me out. You know, and he took it personally. And the Lord said to Samuel, they aren't kicking you out, they're kicking me out. And then finally, you know that story. In 1 Samuel 8, Lord says, well, nevertheless, negotiate with them. And so first he warned them, this will be the manner of a king. Listen to this. What will he do? The famous remonstration about what a king will do. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive orchards, give them to his servants. In other words, the king would follow the pattern of the nations of that day. And he'd have crown land, you see that. And he's got retainers, and he's got a permanent army, and he's got all these people, and his administration, and they're going to take this. He'll take the tenth of your grain and your vineyards and give them to his officers and his servants. You guys will have to pay taxes. And he'll take the tenth of your flocks, and you'll be his slaves. And that day you'll cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but Yahweh will not answer you in that day. And then, you know what the people said? Nay, but we will have a king like all the nations who will go out before us and come in before us and lead our armies. We've got to have it. And so they bought into that. And some people call this the Samuel Compromise. Samuel did anoint the first king. He tried to put that foreign institution, which was magical, into the midst of their covenant. And but before he put the crown on Saul, in 1 Samuel 12, the first thing he did was renew that covenant. And he warned them, and they all said yes. And then he put the crown on him. But he lived to regret it, had to reprove him. And that's the story that runs all the way through. The individual prophets have to stand up against the individual delinquent kings. And while David's progressivism, and David is a worse sinner here in all of all of us, meant an empire and rapid growth of wealth, it's interesting, his first word did not change the basic land tenure situation at all. He tried it once, and that's an interesting story told in the appendix of the book of Samuel, 2 Samuel 27, and his house barely escaped the Lord's plague. Even his general Joab said, don't do that. But Solomon did carry out the reorganization of the tribal boundaries, and thereby, I might say, got the undying hatred of all those northern tribes that later split off and revolted and left the whole thing.
Explain, what did Solomon do?
Solomon reorganized the whole thing into 12 new tribes instead of the old tribes.
I see. Okay.
And his own tribe, Judah, didn't have to pay a bit of taxes. They were scot-free. And the northern tribes said, what's this? And they did it, I suppose, on the basis of 12 months, and they got enough tribute, and everything came into the new bureaucracy down in Jerusalem, you see. And meanwhile, the whole old pattern was being split. You see, when David...
But there was still ownership of land.
Well, yes. But you see, now it's changing because we've got a permanent army there, and David's going to have to give it to his servants, you see. He's got all these mercenaries, Uriah the Hittite and whatnot. And you're getting into the big time, and you got to run it the big time way, see. And there was a lot of conflict. Well, the basic conflict, you all know that story about Naboth's vineyard. The king Ahab wanted to get consolidate his crown property. And the pious Israelite farmer Naboth expressed age-old conservative and religious scruples about that when he would not exchange his patrimony for a better vineyard. He said, God forbid that I should take the inheritance of my fathers and give it to you. And when later the prophet Elijah stands up against him, he doesn't just scold him for killing, he stands up against Ahab for killing Naboth, you know. And Naboth was coached by his wife Jezebel, and she had these Canaanite ideas, these non-Israelite ideas, you see. There the king was absolute monarch. He could do what he wanted, you see. He doesn't scold them. He says, not only hast thou killed, but hast thou taken possession? This doesn't belong to you. This Naboth's vineyard. And that's a matter. That was just one example. And all these earlier confrontations in Israel's history were an individual prophet against an individual king. Samuel against Saul. Nathan against David. Amos against Jeroboam. Isaiah against Hezekiah. Or Ahaz maybe first. But with the rising wealth and class distinctions and the boom time that came in the 8th century under King Jeroboam II, and then everything went out of hand. And God now raised up the new type of prophet. And we usually call them the writing prophets because they're prophecies. were so important that these guys finally put them in writing, documented them, and we finally have them. And these classic prophets now don't just give individual warnings about future things coming to individual kings, but to the whole nation, to the whole enterprise. This is rather important. In other words, the classical prophets, who seemed to be kind of revolutionaries, I don't think they were revolutionaries, they were really conservatives, they simply have a message of doom for the entire nation, both the North and the South. And let's look at that for a minute. Some of them might look like, let's say Amos, might look like he's a revolutionary when he has his run-in with Jeroboam II and the big high priest Amaziah at the sanctuary. In fact, they say there's a conspiracy, and they try to run him out. And his response is, I'm not a prophet. I'm not a professional. I'm not a prophet's son. But the Lord called me from following the flocks, and the Lord said to me, proclaim this to my people Israel. And in the doom article, which then follows, it includes also that he would, and his Amaziah would lose the land that he had and be parceled out by land, and Israel would go into exile. Jeroboam will die by the sword. Israel will go far from its country. And even though in the eyes of the establishment of that day, these prophets did appear as revolutionaries, I think it's quite clear, if you know this whole background, that the standards that these prophets had were the standards of the Old Covenant, which was being violated. They were really conservatives. Just as today, I think that in fighting the fight which we need, at least you can make up your own minds on that, but I think it's the only possibility that what we need to fight in our Christian church today, we are fighting something that is something new and contrary to God's basic covenant. And it's really remarkable to me to see how conservative and traditional, in a good sense, and orthodox, these prophets were. They weren't conventional, that they were just whatever happened to be the newest thing. That's what religion has become in America, conventional. And it's far from orthodoxy. These people here, these prophets, appealed in all of their reasons, for instance, for the coming judgments. If you can study them, you can study them and put down what did he say? Why is it going to be judgment? He'll appeal to the very same things that you had as the stipulations in those covenant renewal festivals. In other words, prophets, instead of being future tellers, are primarily, what a prophet was an intercessor. That's the first thing they had to do in the morning is pray for the people. And when the plague of the grasshoppers first came to Amos, the first thing he did is says, O Lord, forgive. How shall Jacob stand? He is so small. And the Lord forgave. That's what he was supposed to do. And that's why Jeremiah says about the people in Anathoth, I crisscross my heart and hope to die if I'm telling a lie, that I pray for these people every morning. And their idea was not first to give doom. It might be that they might listen if the future punishment were proclaimed to them. The Lord always wants them to return. Perhaps, Amos says, they will return. But when they didn't, then in the last aspect of them, when any attempt to reform them is lost, then they become sayers of doom. So much so that, as a rule of thumb, a general rule of thumb, in Jeremiah 28, when Jeremiah has a run-in with a false prophet, by the way, you know how to tell the difference between a false prophet and a true prophet? The false prophet, in that case, Hananiah, said, oh, everything is going to be hunky-dory. In two years, the exiled king will be back here, and all the vessels that were taken, stolen from the house of the Lord by Nebuchadnezzar in his first coming, 10 years before the destruction of the temple, will be returned, and the millennium will dawn. And, you know, that's the way he said it. In the name of the Lord, thus saith the Lord. You read it in chapter 28 of Jeremiah. And you know what Jeremiah said when he got that oracle? It was face to face. He said, "Amen. I wish you were right." That's the way you're supposed to receive an oracle, by the way. "But I know you're wrong. The tradition in which you and I stand, Hananiah, is a tradition of doom. And things are so out of sort that you can just tell. If a prophet pronounces doom and destruction and wrath, he's a true prophet. You can expect it. If he pronounces salvation the way you are, you better wait till it comes, because you can't tell." Now, we often think these are prophets and nothing but doom, but it's a little more complicated than that. But behind it, these prophets were standing for the covenant and the ongoing social reform that the covenant had traditionally fostered. This doesn't mean that the prophets were merely law speakers, as if their task were merely to reiterate the neglected demands of a long-established covenant. If that would have been what they were, well, then they would have been just renewers of the covenant, guys like Joshua or Samuel. Classic prophets were more. The classic prophets are emergency measures. When the whole system breaks down, then the Lord has to call up a cowboy like Amos, or a man whose wife has been running away from him like Hosea, who knows what it is to hate and to love, and therefore will be able to see farther than anybody else. Someone will have to go for him. And a grievous breakdown in Israelite tradition had occurred. But none of these prophets get anywhere. Each one rises and he simply fades from the picture without accomplishing anything. His words are preserved. We still have them. And the Lord raises up another prophet. But that same thing happens until finally the catastrophe approaches like an avalanche. So each individual prophet in a sense failed, but it isn't true that ultimately that the prophets failed at all. They didn't. And when the new situation came after the avalanche, they really had a promise of hope. And meanwhile, and that's what I want to finish with here, I guess I'm getting a little long, a little time to get here. You should put the clock in front here so that the speaker could get it. The big one reform movement, the only big reform movement, was undertaken. That's the Deuteronomic reform. It's 5 minutes to 12. And I think it's wonderful that there was an attempt, at least, for reformation. It's often attributed to King Josiah, who perhaps is considered the greatest of the kings after David. But I think you ought to see that it was more general, that there was a kind of an underground movement, if you want to call it, that preceded Josiah's activity and even put him forth as a reformer. In fact, it seems that it began underneath Josiah's grandfather, King Manasseh, who reigned so long and was so very wicked. In fact, even the Deuteronomist said, if the Lord hadn't had mercy, the thing would have come to an end right then and there. That man placated the Assyrian overlords in such a way that they just hauled down the Stars and Stripes from in front of the White House and put up the hammer and sickle. You might just well say it that way. Changed the altars and all kinds of stuff. Brought in male and female prostitutes into the temple area, and all the Canaanite, anything that people wanted, they got. And that was too much for a number of people. And so there were reforms. We don't know the entire story of all this, but there was a resistance movement, and it gained a certain, this is very interesting, support among the land-owning farmers in Judah. These people, in some way, since David's day, and they've been fostered, of course, by the line of David, they had at least some orthodoxy, if you want to use that word, and they had at least some good order. And those people were the people that supported a kind of a beginning reform movement. And so they insisted when Josiah's father died, and there was just a little 8-year-old boy, that's all Josiah was at the time, that this fellow be put on the throne, and that all of his regents and so forth and his tutors would shape the outlook of the young king, would also be reform-minded. And then as soon as Assyria's hand slackened, then they pushed forth, and I think Josiah meant to do it too, and he finally became the leader of the movement. They carried out a purge of all the idolatrous Canaanite practices in not only the southern kingdom, but they moved out into what had been Assyrian territory in the north, and even destroyed the famous sanctuary at Bethel. And many of the followers of King Josiah and of this Reformation thought that King Josiah was the Messiah, the messianic savior of the end time, who would put everything right, that the promises of God of a worldwide dominion in genuine righteousness, ruled through his representative, would establish justice on earth. And the event that sparked this, almost like Luther's nailing the 95 Theses on the castle door of the Catholic Church in Wittenberg, was the startling announcement made by the high priest who supervised the repairing and the renovation of the temple. "I found the book of the law in the house of the Lord." Now this scroll, and you tell me who planted it there. Somebody planted it. It has a prehistory. You read von Roth's study of Deuteronomy and it gives you some idea. It certainly had a prehistory. Anyway, it outlined a thoroughgoing program of reform and renewal. The actual measures of this Reformation are so similar to what we find in the book of Deuteronomy today that the rather plausible conclusion has been accepted, I think, by almost all scholars, that the newly found scroll was, if not our present book of Deuteronomy, at least the core, chapters 12, 26. And so the Reformation that was sparked now with the finding of this book, with a real program, you see that, not just general things, putting it in legislation, having blueprints, is called the Deuteronomic Reformation. Now the theses of this Reformation were very simple. There should be the worship of one God over against all this polytheism that's threatened now to come back in. And it was always there underground. And there should be a worship of this one God at one place, and that's Jerusalem, where they could control it. No more shedding of blood. I remember pouring out the lifeblood, cut the throat at any altar was a worship of the Lord. You can't even shed blood any place except at Jerusalem at this one altar. By one clergy, and the clergy had to be the Zadokite clergy, the old hereditary Jerusalem clergy. The minor clergy, the priests, they could become Levites and they could work in the sanctuaries round about and become missionaries, and they did. It was a marvelous thing that they were able to entertain those. You remember in the New Testament, who is it? John the Baptist's father.
Zechariah.
Remember, he was one of those minor clergymen, and he had a certain time when he'd go up to Jerusalem, and then he'd work there. You see, he wasn't really a general Jerusalemite. These are the later Sadducees. Well, such limitations were designed to control the risk of dangerous syncretism with Canaanite. And feverish reform activity now continued in the following years of Josiah's reign. And there were various prophets and prophetesses like Huldah and so forth. And everything that they thought to have ruined their ancient faith and the ancient covenant was simply removed. Now the blueprints were very precise. And if you study this, and I'm not going to go into this, that if you take the older Book of the Covenant in Exodus 21 to 23, I quoted a few things from it earlier, and you compare that to the laws that you have here, you will find that whereas the earlier legislation in Exodus, that say for instance about slaves and field and vineyard in the sabbatical year, was unclear and not explicit on a number of points as to whether the reckoning varied with each field and each owner, or whether the law was general, whether it was across the board applicable on a fixed date. There are a lot of things that aren't settled there. But in Deuteronomy 15, when you come to the same reformulation of this, you can realize that this is a general remission across the board at a fixed date, and it allows no one to refuse a loan to a poorer brother, thinking soon it will be the seventh year of the year of remission. There was nothing wrong with these blueprints for reform, and they still stand in the book of Deuteronomy as, I think, a great achievement. The big problem is that this whole reform program fell. And it wasn't just because King Josiah was killed by Pharaoh Necho, almost like JFK, just before he got things going. But it was that it failed with even the people who supported it. That's the sad thing that Jeremiah had to point out. That the common person, even those land-owning, loyal Judah farmers, those people were more interested in their traditional setup, the inviolability of Jerusalem. They said Jerusalem would never be taken. And he just felt that that Jeremiah was a crank. Jeremiah said that the temple had become a den of robbers. And Jeremiah said that, and he quoted all the stipulations of the covenant that were there. But these other people, they would quote the earlier prophet Isaiah saying, no, the Lord will defend Jerusalem for his name's sake and fend off. So they would not listen to the prophets. And so that age that began with some real promise ended with disaster. Now, it's true that Josiah left a heritage. The book of Deuteronomy is itself, and its program, is a great thing even for us today. I think we can learn much from it. And also a group of people who at least had this conviction, and they were still loyal in their own way. And many of them repented, by the way, after Nebuchadnezzar did come and destroy everything. And all Nebuchadnezzar took into exile, well, in the first place, he just took the blue bloods, the royal house, and the priests. People like Ezekiel was a priest, and the blue bloods, Jehoiakim, and other people like that. The second time when he came, 10 years later, when he destroyed everything in Jerusalem, burned the temple and all that, he took the propertied people. There was a lot of the proletariat that wasn't taken, people who didn't have that. And by the way, that was a very wise thing. He gave their property then to his stooges, including other people who were against this. And so the book of Deuteronomy, with all its reform, was really never implemented. It's a dead letter. And the prophet Jeremiah lived through this. He had a chance to live at state expense in Babylon, live in Acapulco for the rest of your life at state expense. But he didn't. He refused, and he had hope for the land. In fact, he even redeemed property when the land values weren't worth anything. He spent his last money to go out, and his, I think it was a cousin of his, made a killing on it. But that didn't make any difference to Jeremiah, because he still trusted the promises of a new covenant. Behold, the days are coming, saith the Lord, when I'll make a new covenant. Not like the covenant which I brought. Now this is important for us, because we live in that new covenant. Which I made with them when I brought them up out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they broke. But this is my covenant. I'll write my law in their hearts, and they'll all know me. Ezekiel also talks about replacing the hardened heart with the repentant heart.
We're going to not have any time for a discussion.
Oh, okay.
Can you give a couple more?
Yeah, all right. In other words, after this business, a lot of people said reform is out of it. You see that? Some people didn't. The minority didn't. And the minority becomes the future for the people. After, in the post-exilic period, there are some feeble attempts. And if you would compare the land tenure legislation that you will have later, especially in the so-called Holiness Code and the Jubilee year that you talked about, 49 years, you will see that it's patterned on the early stuff, but it really is pushing off the day into kind of a eschatological end time period when the Messiah has come. And they don't do anything practically. Maybe they couldn't, because you see, they were living in the midst, by the time of the return, on the midst of a Persian empire, and the Persians had the political power, you see that. Now, what does this mean for us? Do we learn anything? Is this not the word of God for us? What does this mean for us and our present day problems? And so I guess that's really, I came very close to the end of what I wanted to say. So, and I think our discussion, if you guys want to respond, then I think that would be the best way to do it. Thank you for letting me know this. They run on forever here.
Vern, do you want to respond first?
You got 5 hours. Yeah, fascinating discussion. Thank you very much for it. You put me in mind of Harrison Brown, who says that the United States has 40 years to live, then it's all over. Not because we'll be out of wood or steel or oil or anything else, but simply because as a culture, we have lost the capacity to renew ourselves. And we will destroy ourselves by the process that you just described. You put me in mind of a colleague of mine, named Roy Crossman, which I teach, who persuaded the Congress during the early days of Vietnam that the Congress would appropriate enough money to buy land from the large landholders. I had the privilege of calling his attention to Leviticus in this process, and give the land back to the peasant in Vietnam. The peasant then, owning his own number of hectares, would take possession and then as a landowner resist the incursion from the north. Obviously failed. You put me in mind of Jacques Ellul's only really good book, his first little pamphlet called The Theological Presuppositions of War, in which he says that when the group of people who've been thrown together by some common need escape from Egypt, your description, lose that inner relationship and need and consciousness of it, that the process of the rule-making, the legislation, and so forth, is gradually taken over and corrupted by those in authority to the place where it stops being our law as a community and becomes their law, Saul, and the other people who abuse the process, and therefore were seen as shortly as Kogo's enemy. And the inevitable consequence, of course, as Ellul points out in his book, is that any society goes through this formative period, loses its identity, its common culture, and then destroys itself. The sort of thing that Brown says that we are in the process of doing now in the United States. And certainly one would have to think here, is the word I want, amphectomy?
Yeah.
The Greek and the Israelite experience.
Try that's the word you want. Tell us what it means. That may be the right word.
Two cultures, Greece and Israel.
All right.
Made up of tribes.
Tribal confederacy.
Held together by a common religious experience and belief, okay, rather than by governmental structures, all rather than by constitutions and legislation. And that heresy was such a terrible thing because it struck at the very identity of the people, you say. And it isn't just that you are defaming God. That's bad enough. But you are destroying the very thread and the fabric that binds the people together in a common experience. And you see the treatment of Socrates. Because he denies the thing that binds Greece to the nation. And you see it in the discussion you've just given us happening also in Israel, where you pervert the very thing that binds the people together when you destroy the reality of the religious conception, which is not simply a structure, but is the identity of this commonwealth, of this community. And to try and do it by social reform is not a blessing, it's a curse. It's the parable of the olive tree that refused to be the king and finally wind up with the thorn bush that follows just after he gave it the formation of Samuel's slowness to the night of Saul. And finally, each one of these obviously deserves a little bit more thought than one can give them in a sentence or two, but certainly also it seems to me here that one would have to deal with what you have very, very well introduced for us already, and that is, what was the prophet doing here? Of course, he was not a soothsayer in the sense of predicting the outcome of the next ball game or something like that. But he was a man who tried to interpret what for a man, what these ordinances given by God to the people in this covenant relationship for the good of the people really meant. And in that process, the prophet played this extraordinarily difficult and complex game of saying, remember that this is never, never, never simply an ethical problem. That no law in Israel was ever an ethical problem alone. It was always a combination of the ethical and the people. But unless the rule that was announced not only had the ethical normative structure, but also had the compassion, that what's the impact of this on the widow or the sojourner? That then it could not be, and I even hesitate to use the word that we use all the time, which is our English word for it, because it carries so much negative freight here that it's going to derail us all. Please hold on to your rails now. But the concept of, I wish there were some other English word, the concept of justice. For the process, in this process, I wasn't as good as the lawyer would look at it. See, it is not an ethical problem. It's a payload problem. It's a problem of what's the impact of the Torah on the person. And so the prophet then says, well, the impact of denying the very tradition that makes us the commonwealth, the nation, the invictus. Of setting up, quote, the more efficient land reform, the more efficient governmental structure of the king, leading, of course Solomon had no choice but to destroy the traditional roots of the people who were the rulers of those 12 tribes. And of course he had to rearrange the boundaries of the land that they owned, or else all the traditional strength of that political group would be there, and it would rise one day to kill him the first time he enacted the statute that imposed the tax on that group of people. They had a traditional relationship and traditional boundaries. And to call their campfire meeting, if they'd have an initial 13 or immediately, of course. Solomon had absolutely no choice as a king, except to reshuffle that whole map, divide and destroy. The kind of thing that we see happening all over the world today. Destroying leadership, destroying traditional patterns of government. Also equally, of course, the process of that. And it's over its destruction, the thing that made Israel Israel, just like the thing that made Greece Greece. And so to destroy that pattern of interrelationship among the people, to put me at check on for the annual renewal of the covenant, and say, yes, we are the vassals of the Lord. Yes, he blesses us with his presence. And so, see, on the sheer necessity, you know, if we don't do this, the Philistines will come with their superior iron weapons and carry and better military organization, they will destroy it. Is a radical a denial of faith, and therefore destruction. The battle is an afterthought. The people are already destroyed. In order to respond to what you said, that's the outline of what I think one has to
say. You're saying, this is really what happened, and it's still the reality today. And I guess that's the new way I feel, too. Do you have anything to say about this? We have these books, and I'm very glad we have them. And the prophets are not just predictors, like on Christmas Eve, of the coming of the Messiah. They are that, too. But they are, they have a message, and a social message for us today. All this legislation also has a, let's say, a program for us today.
Sheer poverty, that's what I deal with in the lawyers, sheer poverty, and people who are unable to live in the richness of God's grace. Identity is lost in that common law. Then there is nothing left except to divide the land and draw the line down the middle and say, there you go, lost, and here I go. And the Lord says, good watch, clean up, because the day you step across that line, brother, I'm going to clean you. Then you've got the poverty program by which God permits us legally, socially, to exist for a short time. Hopefully, we cast our breath and renew our senses and understand again the message of salvation. Salvation, you think, is social. But not out of my business. There's nothing that I, as a lawyer, and therefore as one who speaks also for the legislative and the parliamentary and congressional process, can offer except a very brief rest of self-destruction. And in this sense, of course, one hardly ever gets out of life alive.
Let me just couple comments, and then we've got at least 10 more minutes. One is that if there's a chance, this doesn't help this group, if there's a chance that you could break this down into the five mornings of your last week here, we will not run out of material. That's my first reaction. Just over my week. I'm not even sure I understood the first thing Vern said, much less the middle thing you said, and just, okay, so it's too much to tackle. Secondly, this material fits very much the theme for the summer, Light in Our Darkness, and the book by Douglas John Hall. I just want people to know that that's part of what we're going to be talking about. Hall's contention is that the primary theological task today is to contemplate the failure of this dream, and that's not just some pessimistic doomsday person who has stomach troubles and therefore is writing gloomy stuff. That's, I think, the highest form of loyalty to the conservative dream that we had here is to really not say peace, peace when there is no peace, but point to that part which may mean we really are in trouble. Mendel Hall also has a book, The Tenth Generation, which was a way to say welcome to the bicentennial, because the tenth generation is about the 200th year, and that's when you're really in trouble, if you look at historically. So this is going to, an awful lot of the theological discussion, I think, is going to be on themes like this. The difficulty, I think, is going to be when we try to respond to that as to what that means for us, or our lifestyle, or charging interest or not charging interest when you loan your friend some money. Sometime I think you have to have some place where you don't give the idea that a little thing I do today is going to solve it, but if it's only so overwhelming that there's nothing I can do and you feel just incapacitated by the discussion, I'm not sure that's the only thing that resulted in the hearing of God's word or results in discussion either. So I guess the final thing I would call for is if there are some people either during the coffee break or afterwards who want to continue it, there is no session at 10:45 or a hike, and I just didn't want us to end with a frustration, or at least maybe some of us can continue to visit, so you don't go at 10:15, say fine, have your cup of coffee, and people are just kind of, you know, what did he say? All right. So let's spend the 7 minutes we do have, but if you want to pick up on it at some other point today, we can do that. Some people are nodding, so apparently not the only one who felt kind of.
I didn't mean to overboard you. In fact, I brought this along only because I'm rewriting and preparing this for publication, and wrote it more or less to put all these things out down, and I don't really draw many conclusions.
Another suggestion is if you want some of this in the context of a theology of enough, this today really flows from yesterday's discussion. The third chapter of Taylor's book, over in the bookstore, John B. Taylor, called A Theology of Enough, picks up on the gleaning, the never hitting the olive branch twice, the charging of interest, jubilee year, so that some of the material you gave today, if you want to have a little more time to read it, that's in the library or it is a paperback. So he does some of the same things you do.
Maybe this is jumping way ahead, but what could be done in America? Maybe it was you or someone else mentioned this week, and but we've known for a long time the gap between the rich and poor is becoming even more and more, you know, in our country. People who have are getting a lot more, and the people who don't have seem to be having less. How could this be redistributed without a form of communism, where maybe Christianity might be the key to having a good distribution of God's gifts?
I understood, Vern, as long as there is that sense of I trust you, you trust me, there's hope. When that breaks down, historically, the legislation of it was not successful. Am I correct?
That's right. I don't think
And law can't ensure it. And so I think without some dimension that you're calling for, historically, there's a pessimistic answer to whether or not. Can you cite historically any time that the people in power voluntarily handed the power over to those who didn't have it? No. Finally, those who didn't have it took some.
Well,
grabbed some.
I will see.
The power, but wealth.
Yeah.
We just,
well, I was,
yeah.
The day before you came, Mr. Ingeborg led us in his second letter, you know, and one of the outstanding, you know, sentences there was, you know, the accumulation of wealth for yourself or for your children is the beginning of injustice. So, right there.
I think there was a bit of a hope here in Jeremiah's promise that what he saw as the end of the old covenant, and he saw it very clearly in the new covenant, is that God would then write in the heart of his people his Torah, his instruction. And they would all know him from the least to the greatest. And they would not ask anymore or say one to another, know the Lord, one mediator, one prophet, one king, one expert knowing it. But they would all know it. And then he adds with a punchline, and I'll forgive their iniquity and I'll remember their sins no more, which I think has to be explored. What does that mean for a New Testament Christian? You see, do we have resources? If we take this seriously, and I think we should, that God is in Jesus, and Jesus called his last supper, the new covenant in his blood, and gives the Holy Spirit and a new heart, then don't we also have that social dimension? Don't we have that promise? In other words, I think there is embedded within these prophets, promise, not just the fact that there's going to be an avalanche so bad, And then we simply say, this is what's going to be repeated here in America. But that he also holds promise. I might respond to yours. When I was working through this, I read a number of Paul Tillich's, I'm not really a Tillich fan, but some or other, I was studying him at that time, read a number of his political things, and his very early essays when he was a religious socialist. I guess it was a very theoretical sort of thing, but I found it absolutely fascinating. And I think there is such a alternative. And it's called socialism, it doesn't have to be called communism. It would seem to me just right off the bat, and I'm very naive here, just as I look at that theoretically, that this would fit much greater and much more normally with what Vern is talking about and what the ethic of Jesus. And therefore, I welcome such a thing. But when I look at socialistic platforms in the United States, I'm a bit horrified and I say, well, maybe I stick where I am as a non-aligned voter, voting sometimes against Mayor Daley and the Democrats and sometimes for the Democrats, you know what I mean, depending upon where I am. But even such a thing as belong to Common Cause, and at least they came out with a statement recently.
They belong to what?
Common Cause.
Common
Cause. And on the energy crisis, you know, otherwise all you read is this back and forth and you wonder what in the world is. Sure, I think I've known for a long time to cut down on energy. A point of conscience for me to have when my old car is falling apart to even consider getting a new car. But that doesn't relieve me of the social obligations that I have here in America. And so I was glad to have some blueprints. And I'm glad now, look at the blueprints in Common Cause, but at least they have something to shoot for. And at least, and if someone knows some better ones, well, fine. But I think we have to have such guidelines. I don't see where we can get by. Now, maybe some of the commissions, I don't know all the work of Lutheran World Federation, but at least they would seem to be responsible also in this area. And I suppose they are.
Instead of commission trusts.
Yeah.
The whole concept, there are books on village technocracy, for example, how to build a well that gives you pure water and the other things. They really trust. Another time, John, I hear a bell, so I'm like, I guess that's not just in my head.
No, it's a coffee break, so it's not.
But another time, if we come back, well, if we come back, I got another jewel to drop.
Let me give one more thing as you go. This summer, for the first time, John Howard Yoder will be on faculty of Mennonite.
Fascinating man. I've heard him and I've read his book, Politics of Jesus, is the only book I read four times in the last 3 years. When I read it three more times. And I can't say that on any other book except I'm trying to do the scripture regularly. But other books, I don't read that often. I think he'll bring a kind of thing that will be very challenging to Lutherans if he keeps with the themes that I've heard him do. He will kind of challenge us that there's nowhere that you're called to make history come out right, but you are called to be faithful. And if you can't change the whole social system in the United States to take care of poverty, personally, we can be faithful about our riches and poor people. And he calls for that kind of Mennonite strain of living out a counterculture. I mean, we're used to kind of chaplains to the system, legislative common cause, and I think we have something to offer Mennonites too, but they come in with a kind of before you spend all your time changing the legislation in Georgia, maybe the Koinonia Farms just living an integrated community ahead of its time really was part of that which busted old wineskins with new wine. Maybe if enough of us loan money without any interest, instead of trying to change the whole banking industry of the United States, you're never going to do that. If enough people live a kind of counterculture, finally you have new wine and the old wineskins are bursting anyway. I think there's going to be some interesting discussion for primarily Lutherans listening to a Mennonite that comes with a very different kind of attitude what our responsibility is and what faithfulness means in the midst of that. But we're going to have some good talks.
He comes in July.
I think it's July and early August. And Chuck Lutz will be coming the June 18th, and he is commissioned, I think, by the ALC to do a study of Christianity in a capitalist country, that one we, and Tanzania and Jules Nayer, Christianity in a socialist country. So at least we begin not to think in terms of Christian and only our understanding of an economic system. I think there's a lot of good mix going on. Now you all have to stay. That's the June is. That's my director's sales pitch.